Namaste. Bonne année. Happy New Year. We enter 2016. We're at the end of tonight's session at about the halfway point in the second chapter of the second book, Brahman Purusha Ishvara. Maya Prakriti Shakti. Sri Aurobindo in recent pages has been speaking of an absolute, a reality that is transcendental, cosmic, personal, dynamic, yet static, immutable, but moving, infinite, but finite. We begin tonight with the paragraph that describes the infinite. Our conception of the infinite is formlessness. But everywhere we see form and forms surrounding us, and it can be and is affirmed of the divine being that he is at once form and the formless. So in philosophy, when we speak about an infinite, we think of something that is beyond any measure and therefore cannot have any form. Only what has form has been measured out in some way. And of course, in Indian philosophy, it's measured out by Maya. Maya is that cunning capacity of the divine consciousness to form within itself a figure which represents the all that it is. And all is a mere term hinting at what is an unknowable reality. So, a divine being that is both form and formless, that is the real infinite to Sri Aurobindo. For here, too, the apparent contradiction does not correspond to a real opposition. The formless is not a negation of the power of formation, but the condition for the infinite's free formation. For otherwise, there would be a single form, or only a fixity or sum of possible forms in a finite universe. So forms are drawn out of the formless. The formless is a ground of being from which formation is drawn and occurs. The formlessness is the character of the spiritual essence, the spirit substance of the reality. All finite realities are powers, forms, self-shapings of that substance. The divine is formless and nameless, but by that very reason, capable of manifesting all possible names and shapes of being. We're speaking about names and shapes here because critically important to Indian philosophy is the idea of nama and rupa, paired together. Nama, name, rupa, form. And speaking of the reality, how is it that from an infinite comes this particular shape? Why is it called thus? What does the naming of it signify? These things are important considerations in Indian thought, and we will discuss that much as we go along. Forms, he writes, are manifestations, not arbitrary inventions out of nothing. Goes back to his earlier comment, distinguishing creation from manifestation. Creation is something out of nothing. This is the theistic idea in many religions, that a world is manifested from nothing, can't be, or created from nothing, can't be brought out of the divine's own being, because how would we explain the imperfections of the world if it seemed to be part of a God who is all perfect. And so there's this distance, this gulf between God and creation. Sri Aurobindo has said, no, the universe is a manifestation of the divine. It is always, in a sense, implied there. The potentiality for the universe is always there, even when it's not apparent. It manifests when it becomes clear to the view. Always it was there, now it is manifest. So again, forms are manifestations, not arbitrary inventions out of nothing. So they are real. For line and color, mass and design, which are the essentials of form, carry always in them a significance, are, it might be said, secret values and significances of an unseen reality made visible, manifestation. It is for that reason that figure, line, hue, mass, composition can embody what would be otherwise unseen, can convey what would be otherwise occult to the sense. Occult, again, a word that simply means hidden. Form may be said to be the innate body, the inevitable self-revelation of the formless. And this is true not only of external shapes, but of the unseen formations of mind and life, which we seize only by our thought, and those sensible forms of which only the subtle grasp of the inner consciousness can become aware. So rupa, form, derives from an inner reality. Innate means inborn. It's something that's always present. So if it comes into being, if it comes into manifestation, if it's made clear, it's because it always was there. We didn't really create it. We helped it become manifest as an artist, as a poet, as a thinker. These things get articulated or given a shape, but always they existed, perhaps pre-existed, going back to the old Indian philosophic idea of Satkaryavada, that what is true and real is carried forward in the extension of causation. Everything that happens comes out of that one reality. Name, in its deeper sense, nama, is not the word by which we describe the object, but the total of power, quality, character of the reality which a form of things embodies and which we try to sum up by a designating sound, a knowable name, nomen. Nomen, in this sense we might say, is noumen. The secret names of the gods are their power, quality, character of being, caught up by the consciousness and made conceivable. So nomen means name, noumen means, well, spirit, divinity. It comes from a word that really means a nod, as if something that you're in conversation with nods and gives assent. So when you're speaking to the spirit of a tree, it says, yes, I am here, I listen to you. And it nods, and that is the noumen, the indwelling spirit. So these two things, in a sense, blend together. The name of something has an indwelling power in it. The name gives a significant form, captures something of the essence of what's in that shape. And so the name has power because it has inner reality and force within it. He continues, the infinite is nameless. But in that namelessness, all possible names, noumens of the gods, the names and forms of all realities are already envisaged and prefigured because they are there, latent and inherent in the all existence. So they're not episodic, random creations, they inhere in that reality and become clear when they become manifest. Then they have form, then they have name, and their spirit is contactable, tangible to the inner sense. You find something like this in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad at 4.2 and 4.3. It becomes clear from these considerations that the coexistence of the infinite and the finite, which is the very nature of universal being, is not a juxtaposition or mutual inclusion of two opposites, but as natural and inevitable as the relation of the principle of light and fire with the suns. So as the infinite, as a transcendence, leans into the vastness of the cosmos, these are not mutually exclusive or opposites. They are, in fact, something each of the other. They coexist. The universe exists within the transcendence, and within the transcendence always is present, the universe, waiting for the auspicious time to manifest, what we might call Brahma Muhurta, the hour of God, when suddenly it stands forth and the divinity reveals itself. Reveals itself in the cosmos as the cosmos. The finite, he writes, is a frontal aspect, so the rest lies behind, and a self-determination of the infinite, because nothing tells it what to do. The infinite decides, I shall be this, and so brings itself forward as a finite representation. No finite can exist in itself and by itself. It exists by the infinite, and because it is of one essence with the infinite. So no finite expression ever gives birth to itself. It is the expression of the infinite reality. So everything that we see and experience, everything that we contact, has been breathed forth by that divine immensitude. By that infinity, has authentic being behind it, even if to our scale in valuations it seems poor and pathetic, the infinite is completely contactable in its presence. Isn't that something to give us humility? For by the infinite, we do not mean solely an illimitable self-extension in space and time, but something that is also spaceless and timeless, a self-existent, indefinable, and illimitable, which can express itself in the infinitesimal as well as in the vast, in a second of time, in a point of space, in a passing circumstance. This artists and poets and musicians and lovers know intuitively, because we feel eternity in a moment. We see in a particular form, even though it's fragile, the expression of a vastness. We see something timeless, spaceless, represented in time and space, whether in thought or figure, whether in life force, an exchange of energies, whatever it might be, we find that is there, authenticating the experience, authenticating the insight. The finite is looked upon as a division of the indivisible, but there is no such thing. For this division is only apparent. There is a demarcation, but no real separation is possible. When we see with the inner vision and sense, and not with the physical eye, a tree or other object, what we become aware of is an infinite one reality constituting the tree or object, pervading its every atom and molecule, forming them out of itself, building the whole nature, process of becoming, operation of indwelling energy. All of these are itself, are this infinite, this reality. We see it extending indivisibly and uniting all objects so that none is really separate from it or quite separate from other objects. It stands, says the Gita, undivided in beings and yet as if divided. Thus, each object is that infinite and one in essential being with all other objects that are also forms and names, powers, noumens of the infinite. Avibhaktam cha bhuteshu, vibhaktam eva cha sthitam. This is the citation from the beginning of the chapter. This is chapter 13, 16 or 17, however you like to describe it, in the Bhagavad Gita. This incoercible unity. Incoercible means that which cannot be restrained or confined. It's an old term. It hasn't been used since the 18th and 19th century much. This incoercible unity in all divisions and diversities is the mathematics of the infinite, indicated in a verse of the Upanishads. This is the complete, and that is the complete. Subtract the complete from the complete is the remainder. Well, we opened our evening with that very verse. Purnam madha, purnam midam. You could also say, that is full, this is full. The full is taken out of the full. Take out the full from the full remains. For so too, it may be said of the infinite self-multiplication of the reality, that all things are that self-multiplication. The one becomes many, but all these many are that which was already and is always itself, and in becoming the many, remains the one. There is no division of the one by the appearance of the finite, for it is the one infinite that appears to us as the many finite. The creation adds nothing to the infinite. It remains after creation what it was before. The infinite is not a sum of things. It is that which is all things and more. If this logic of the infinite contradicts the conceptions of our finite reason, it is because it exceeds it and does not base itself on the data of the limited phenomenon, but embraces the reality and sees the truth of all phenomena in the truth of the reality. It does not see them as separate beings, movements, names, forms, things. For that they cannot be, since they could be that only if they were phenomena in the void, a la Buddhism, things without a common basis or essence, fundamentally unconnected, connected only by coexistence and pragmatic relation, not realities which exist by their root of unity and, so far as they can be considered independent, are secured in their independence of outer or inner figure and movement, only by their perpetual dependence on their parent infinite, their secret identity with the one identical. The identical is their root, their cause of form, the one power of their varying powers, their constituting substance. So everything not only partakes of that one infinite, but is an expression of it. And the entirety of that infinite is discoverable in every finite thing. Yes, the complete infinite is at the very center of it. So any experience that we have, therefore, if we get to the penetralia of the experience, follow the thought to its source, should be able to lead us back, impliedly, to the experience of that which is the whole and beyond the whole. So in other words, everything is a pathway back to that. Everything is not simply a symbol, but a passageway, a dynamic passageway to take you back. So can you say that yoga has endless paths? Yes. And you can verify it in your own life. The identical is their root. The identical. It is one identity, one conscious person, one being. What we have described as Satchitananda, that is at the center of all things, manifest or held back from manifestation. Their cause of form. The one identical deliberately manifests, does not accidentally or casually manifest. It does it with supreme authority into every strand of its manifestation. And behind all the empowerments, all the gods, all the goddesses, every force of nature is this one power that comes out of the Chit Shakti. And what does the Chit Shakti use as the substance of this expression but the being of itself, Sat, Chit, and the play of Ananda. Tangible in all things. He continues, having described the infinite, the identical to our notions is the immutable, in other words, what is unchangeable, from mutare, to change in Latin. It is ever the same through eternity, for if it is, or becomes subject to mutation, or if it admits of differences, it ceases to be identical. But what we see everywhere is an infinitely variable, fundamental oneness which seems the very principle of nature. So from being, the basic force is one, but it manifests from itself innumerable forces. The basic substance is one, but it develops many different substances and millions of unlike objects. Mind is one, but differentiates itself into many mental states, mind formations, thoughts, perceptions, differing from each other and entering into harmony or into conflict. Life is one, but the forms of life are unlike and innumerable. Humanity is one in nature, but there are different race types, and every individual man is himself, and in some way, unlike others. Nature insists on tracing lines of difference on the leaves of one tree. She drives differentiation so far that it has been found that the lines on one man's thumb are different from the lines of every other man's thumb, so that he can be identified by that differentiation alone. Yet, fundamentally, all men are alike, and there is no essential difference. So he's gone through this from being, force, and ranges of consciousness through mind and life, down to the particular formation in matter. Oneness or sameness, he says, is everywhere. Differentiation is everywhere. The indwelling reality has built the universe on the principle of the development of one seed into a million different fashions. So the multitude do not cancel out or deny the oneness. The oneness is not restricted to a numerical oneness. It expands expressively into uncountable numbers of forms. But this again, he says, is the logic of the infinite. Because the essence of the reality is immutably the same, it can assume securely these innumerable differences of form and character and movement. For even if they were multiplied a trillionfold, that would not affect the underlying immutability of the eternal identical. Because the self and spirit and things and beings is one everywhere, therefore, nature can afford this luxury of infinite differentiation. If there were not this secure basis which brings it about that nothing changes, yet all changes, all her workings and creations would in this play collapse into disintegration and chaos. There would be nothing to hold her disparate movements and creations together. This is a fundamental plank of the Vedanta, by the way, that within this one being occur all these mutations, and yet they're mutations of the same being, and the same being never is lost in the distribution of itself into form. So what Sri Aurobindo is writing here is completely consonant with the highest principles of Vedanta. The immutability of the identical, to continue, does not consist in a monotone of changeless sameness incapable of variation. Did I skip a sentence? Let me back up and read in case I did. Because the self and spirit in things and beings is one everywhere, therefore nature can afford this luxury of infinite differentiation. If there were not this secure basis which brings it about that nothing changes, yet all changes, all her workings and creations would, in this play, collapse into disintegration and chaos. There would be nothing to hold her disparate movements and creations together. The immutability of the identical does not consist in a monotone of changeless sameness incapable of variation. It consists in an unchangeableness of being which is capable of endless formation of being, but which no differentiation can destroy or impair or minimize. The self becomes insect and bird and beast and man, but it is always the same self through these mutations, because it is the one who manifests himself infinitely in endless diversity. And this is the Shvetashvatara Upanishad 4.4. Our surface reason is prone to conclude that the diversity may be unreal, an appearance only. But if we look a little deeper, we shall see that a real diversity brings out the real unity, shows it, as it were, in its utmost capacity, reveals all that it can be and is in itself, delivers from its whiteness of hue the many tones of color that are fused together there. Oneness finds itself infinitely in what seems to us to be a falling away from its oneness, but is really an inexhaustible, diverse display of unity. This is the miracle, the Maya of the universe, yet perfectly logical, natural, and a matter of course to the self-vision and self-experience of the infinite. So in maximum diversity, the infinite is showing symbolically what it's capable of. Even if it manifested a million universes, all of them filled with endless variations and forms, it still would not express all that it is as an infinite. But it expresses the potentiality of it. And in its measuring out of this or any or all universes, it uses its self-conceptive power. Self-aware, deliberately through an act of will, condensing itself into this form and that form, as a universe, as an individual being within a universe which is itself a universe. And that is the power of Maya. As he says, for the Maya of Brahman is at once the magic and the logic of an infinitely variable oneness. If indeed there were only a rigid monotone of limited oneness and sameness, there would be no place for reason and logic. For logic consists in the right perceptions of relations. The highest work of reason is to find the one substance, the one law, the cementing latent reality, connecting and unifying the many, the different, the discordant, and disparate. So this is the full scope of philosophy. It's to confirm our greatest spiritual experience, which is to become one with that supreme, beyond the universe, in the universe, and in all personal individuation. All universal existence, he says, moves between these two terms, a diversification of the one, a unification of the many and diverse. And that must be because the one and the many are fundamental aspects of the infinite. For what the divine self-knowledge and all knowledge brings out in its manifestation must be a truth of its being, and the play of that truth is its lila. Lila means play. So far, then, he's discussed being, and now he's going to move into the subject of consciousness. So first, sat, the nature of sat, and now the nature of chit. This, then, is the logic of the way of universal being of Brahman and the basic working of the reason, the infinite intelligence of Maya. As with the being of Brahman, so with its consciousness, Maya. It is not bound to a finite restriction of itself, or to one state or law of its action. It can be many things simultaneously, have many coordinated movements, which, to the finite reason, may seem contradictory. It is one, but innumerably manifold, infinitely plastic, inexhaustibly adaptable. Maya is the supreme and universal consciousness and force of the eternal and infinite, and being by its very nature unbound and illimitable, it can put forth many states of consciousness at a time, many dispositions of its force, without ceasing to be the same consciousness force forever. You can see what an immense consciousness this is, and Sri Aurobindo in earlier chapters has identified this power of Maya, this conceptive consciousness of the divine, as supramental in its essence. It is at once transcendental, universal, and individual. It is the supreme supracosmic being that is aware of itself as all being, as the cosmic self, as the consciousness force of cosmic nature, and at the same time experiences itself as the individual being and consciousness in all existences. Supracosmic, what is beyond the cosmos, it is that being which is innately pure, undivided, unmanifest. It is the all-being which manifests as the cosmic self, the consciousness force behind cosmic nature, so not simply the display, but the consciousness force that impels it. So it is both the name and the form, isn't it? At the same time, it experiences itself as the universe in the individual, and the individual in the universe. and finds that that same consciousness is established in all existences. The individual consciousness can see itself as limited and separate, but can also put off its limitations and know itself as universal and again as transcendent of the universe. This is because there is in all these states or positions, or underlying them, the same triune consciousness in a triple status. That is Satchit Ananda. That is triple status also, transcendent, universal, individual. There is then no difficulty in the one thus seeing or experiencing itself triply, whether from above in the transcendent existence, or from between in the cosmic self, or from below in the individual conscious being. All that is necessary for this to be accepted as natural and logical is to admit that there can be different real statuses of consciousness of the one being, and that cannot be impossible for an existence which is free and infinite, and cannot be tied to a single condition. A free power of self-variation must be natural to a consciousness that is infinite. It must contain potency, expressibility, as well as sheer being. It must have power as well as status. It must have innumerability as much as oneness, all of it inherent within its own supreme being. If the possibility of a manifold status of consciousness is admitted, no limit can be put to the ways of its variation of status, provided the One is aware of itself simultaneously in all of them, for the One and Infinite must be thus universally conscious. The only difficulty which a further consideration may solve is to understand the connections between a status of limited or constructed consciousness like ours, a status of ignorance, and the infinite self-knowledge and all knowledge. Because admittedly, our consciousness, which is restricted, which has its scope and its limit, even as we're evolving, that limit expands and grows, is not aware of the transcendence and the universality and the individuality of that transcendent universality all at the one time. We get glimpses here and there in our profoundest experiences. We may enter into it. Do we retain that? Are we without let or hindrance aware of that? No. So, the divine must be. And what to explain that difference? What is the nature of that connection between the finite and the infinite? Will be something of Sri Aurobindo's coming argument. I think we've come to a good stopping point for the evening. We'll place our bookmarks there. And if you can hear some of Sri Aurobindo's sublime poetry tonight, we'll go to the kingdoms, the kingdoms and godheads of the little mind, book 2, canto 10. In the bright kingdoms of the rising sun, all is a birth into a power of light. All here deformed guards there its happy shape. Here all is mixed and marred, there pure and whole. Yet each is a passing step, a moment's phase. Awake to a greater truth beyond her acts. The mediatrix sat and saw her works, and felt the marvel in them and the force, but knew the power behind the face of time. She did the task, obeyed the knowledge given. Her deep heart yearned towards great ideal things, and from the light looked out to wider light. A brilliant hedge drawn round her narrowed her power. Faithful to her limited sphere she toiled, but knew its highest, widest seeing was a half-search, its mightiest acts a passage or a stage. For not by reason was creation made, and not by reason can the truth be seen, which, through the veils of thought, the screens of sense, hardly the spirit's vision can descry, dimmed by the imperfection of its means. The little mind is tied to little things. Its sense is but the spirit's outward touch, half waked in a world of dark inconscience. It feels out for its beings and its forms, like one left fumbling in the ignorant night. In this small mold of infant mind and sense, desire is a child heart's cry, crying for bliss. Our reason, only a toy's artificer, a rule maker in a strange stumbling game. But she, her dwarf aides, knew, whose confident sight a bounded prospect took for the far goal. The world she has made is an interim report of a traveler towards the half-found truth in things, moving twixt nescience and nescience. For nothing is known while aught remains concealed. The truth is known only when all is seen. Attracted by the all that is the one, she yearns towards a higher light than hers. Hid by her cults and creeds, she has glimpsed God's face. She knows she has but found a form, a robe, but ever she hopes to see him in her heart and feel the body of his reality. As yet a mask is there and not a brow, although sometimes two hidden eyes appear. Reason cannot tear off that glimmering mask. Her efforts only make it glimmer more. In packets she ties up the indivisible, finding her hands too small to hold vast truth. She breaks up knowledge into alien parts, or peers through cloud rack for a vanished sun. She sees, not understanding what she has seen, through the locked visages of finite things, the myriad aspects of infinity. One day, the face must burn out through the mask. Our ignorance is wisdom's chrysalis. Our error weds new knowledge on its way. Its darkness is a blackened knot of light. Thought dances hand in hand with nescience on the gray road that winds towards the sun. Even while her fingers fumble at the knots which bind them to their strange companionship, into the moments of their married strife sometimes break flashes of the enlightening fire. Even now great thoughts are here that walk alone. Armed, they have come with the infallible word in an investiture of intuitive light that is a sanction from the eyes of God. Announcers of a distant truth they flame, arriving from the rim of eternity. A fire shall come out of the infinitudes. A greater gnosis shall regard the world, crossing out of some far omniscience, on lustrous seas, from the still wrapped alone, to illumine the deep heart of self and things. A timeless knowledge it shall bring to mind, its aim to life, to ignorance, its close. So, for this evening, then, that's our study in the life divine. Bonne année. Welcome to the new year, 2016. Jai Ma. Namaste. I salute what is divine in you.